I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Dana P. from San Diego.
I feel so tall. Hi. Love it. Hi, my name is Dana Pretty, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Dana.
And my sobriety date is August 17, 1998. My sponsor's name is Eileen O. Her sponsor is Patty C. And her sponsor is Debbie W. I have a relationship with all three of these women, and all three of these women have been through the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all three of them live in New Jersey. So you don't know them. I have a home group. It's the Friday Night Gifts of Grace. It's a woman's meeting. If you ever would have told me that my home group would have been a woman's meeting, I would have told you were nuts. And it isn't because I don't love women in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because I hate women's meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the truth. First off, I want to say congratulations, happy anniversary to the celebrants. We call them anniversaries on the East Coast. I will never call them birthdays. Thank you very much for speaking. I really appreciated it. It's good to be here tonight. I always laugh about when I get asked to speak in California, because in where I'm from on the East Coast, they get you coming in the door. You know, they're like, oh, you want to speak? Come on, get up there. You know, we're happy if you put clothes on. And if you don't, we'll make do with it, you know? Here it's like they ask you 6 months in advance. I mean, I don't know where I'm going to be. I don't know where I live half the time. You know what I mean? I've moved 12 times in 13 years, you know? So I never know where I'm going to be on any given moment, you know? I so appreciate the advanced notice. But, you know, if you get me at the door, I love it, you know? And that's what I'm used to. So I'm not from California. I know you're all shocked. Who's shocked? Raise your hand. I don't have an accent. I heard that. I do not have an accent. Alcoholics Anonymous. Who would have thought, right? I'm 32 years old. I got here when I was 18 years old. Well, no, I got here when I was 17 years old, and I looked around the room at the sea of old people. Old was 30 at the time. It's not old anymore. For those of you young ones, I looked around at the sea of faces, and I thought, oh, God, no. No. No, no. This is not going to be my life. You know, and I was thinking about my life. You know, I just had an anniversary, and I was thinking about my life over the past 13 years since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you would have told me 13 years ago that this is what my life would have looked like, I would have told you were nuts. I always like to have my girls write down their plans for their life, a year from now, 5 years from now, just write it down, put it somewhere, and tuck it away, you know, and take out that paper, because I will promise you, if you open your heart up to what is possible in this program, and if you develop a relationship with the God of your understanding, and if you build relationships with the people in this program, you will have sold yourself so short. I promise you that. I guarantee it. I was in San Francisco 2 weeks ago for IKIPA, which is the International Conference for Young People in AA, and my center of Alcoholics Anonymous is huge. I've lived lots of places. I have friends all over the world, and it really is huge, you know. And so my best friend lives in Fort Myers, Florida. She's moving to Chicago. I'm so jealous. And my other girl, so our room was me from who lives in San Diego, my girlfriend Liz, who's from Denver, my little Kaya, who's from New York, Danielle from New York, and my best friend Jenny, who lives in Florida, you know, and friends from Hawaii and Israel and all over the place, you know. My girlfriends from Arizona were in town, and I think about my world when I was drinking was like the Badlands in Philly, you know, so I could get what I needed and like my bedroom, you know, like that was my whole world. I had nothing outside of that. Nobody called me. Nobody wanted to, like, go on vacation with me or hang out with me. I mean, when I had gotten out of rehab at one point, it was one Christmas time, and I went, my best friend from high school and my other girlfriend, they picked me up, because I didn't have a car. I mean, it was a car. They picked me up, and they took me to Kristen's house, and You know, they were like wrapping Christmas presents for their families, you know, oh yay, Christmas. And I was trying to buy pot from her 12-year-old brother and stealing nips out of the fridge. Remember the little Coors Light nips? And drinking them. I mean, that was my life right before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you were going to take that away from me. The nerve of you, you know. And I would, so when I got here, you know, when I saw all the old people, it was funny because a few years ago when I was in my late 20s, I moved back to Jersey, and one of my sponsees, we were going out. She was 17. Holly was 17. She ended up overdosing, and her parents found her in her car. And I pray for her family every day. But we were walking into this diner, and you know, because we would go to our Friday night Big Book meeting, and then you know, like 15 people go out for dinner afterwards. And she says, "You know, Dana, like when you were young in AA." I was like, and Blake looks at me. My best friend looks at me and goes, "Dana, she's 17, you're almost 30. Like, imagine what that looks like to her." You know, I was just devastated. I was devastated, you know, and when I'm at Icky Paw, I'm watching these 15, 16-year-old kids, and I'm going, "Oh, my God, Liz, can you look at the way, look at what they're doing? Oh, my God." And she's going, "We did that when we were their age. We did that, you know." And I'm so grateful that I got to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really am. I feel so blessed and because there is this community within this community of people who get sober young. And if you're young and you're sober, I encourage you to find that community. Because if it wasn't for that community, I wouldn't be here today. I know that. I needed people to identify with, and I needed people to hang out with, you know. And because my girlfriends were still drinking and smoking pot. I mean, that's what they were doing, you know. Or they were in jail. I mean, that's what my life looked like, you know. And So I'll just tell you a little bit about what it was like. I'm not a big drunkalog person. Number one, I only drank for 7 years, so there's not really much to tell. And number two, I knew how to drink when I got here. I didn't need you to tell me how to drink. I needed you desperately to tell me how to stay sober, because that I couldn't do. So hopefully that's what I'm going to talk about tonight is what I do on a daily basis to stay sober and how I got here. So I took my first drink. I grew up in a little town called Allentown, literally like George Washington marched through there. The town's like 400 and something years old, and there's no traffic lights. And my mom, they moved back out in by Princeton, and my parents raised both my nephews, and because my sister is still out experimenting. And I said to my mom, because they're looking for it now, she needs a bigger house because she's got two kids, you know. And I said, "What about Allentown?" She goes, "Oh, God, no. I mean, literally, like, if you don't have everything you need by 8 o'clock, like, it's over, you know." And that's just where I grew up. And so we did things like drank in the woods, you know, like in the barn, like, woohoo, right? Like, I'm not a hick. I swear to God, I'm not a hick. I lived in New York City. I will get there, but I did. So I was 11 years old, and my parents are like these old school hippies, you know, and they smoke pot, they do their thing, whatever, you know. I've never seen my father in the 32 years I've been on this earth take a sip of alcohol. The first time I remembered seeing her drink, she was 36 years old, and I remember thinking, like, that's really weird because my mom doesn't drink, and I don't know if she's alcoholic. I know that when she drinks like I drink. But that's between her and her God and the relationship that she has, you know. So my parents were like kind of like chill, just to kind of give you an idea. So at 11 years old, and we really didn't keep any booze in our house unless they had friends coming in from like out of town, out of the country. And so there was like a big bottle of red wine. I don't know how it got there, but anyway, there's this big bottle of red wine, and we have a finished basement on the East Coast. You have basements, and ours was finished. And so I would run up the stairs. I'd pour myself a glass of wine. I'd drink it. I'd run back down the stairs. I'd run up, back down. And this went on until the bottle of red wine was gone. And I was really drunk. And I went in my room, and I laid on the bed, and it's spun and spun and spun, and I threw up. And I woke up the next day, and I said to my mom, "I'm never going to do that again. I am never going to," and I didn't. I never drank a big bottle of red wine all by myself. So I learned my lesson. but I would drink warm Coors Light, like with the best of them, you know. And I, you know, and I didn't have hangovers. I was like one of those drinkers that I was like, I would drink four and go throw up, and then drink four and go throw up. And so I didn't black out. And I love this, the speaker that I love, Michael M. She talks about how envious she was of blackout drinkers. And I am so envious of you because you just don't remember. I got to remember every horrid detail of the things that I did. And it still didn't stop me, you know? So I'm drinking, and then I start doing other things, and I respect the fact that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to tell you that I loved to smoke pot, and I loved to stick needles in my arms. I mean, once I found that, I was like, oh, this is like instantaneous. I mean, you can't beat this. The problem was is I would just literally pass out for a couple hours. So, but that's where my drinking took me. And I so desperately wanted your approval. I so desperately wanted you to tell me I was okay. And from the outside, everything looked good. I had the right credentials. I was class president. I was on the school board. I got good grades in school. I was very active, blah, 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 blah. I did all of these things. And so that, for me, was the license to do whatever I wanted to do. And so my senior year of high school, what happens? What happens with most alcoholics is worlds collide, right? Did your worlds collide? Mine collided. Only I was a senior in high school when they started to collide. My alcoholism had now become a full-time job. It wasn't fun anymore. My friends started to notice that I had picked up a nice little habit of robbing people. And people don't want to hang out with people who steal from people, you know? And I had no problem. My stuff, that was different, but I didn't mind selling your stuff. And so I would rip people off. And I mean, it was like me and like my girlfriends, and we were just nuts, and my sister, and it was nuts. And so I ended up getting suspended from school because worlds collide and blah, blah, blah. And so at the end of the year where I went to high school, they read off two lists. One is a list of people who aren't going to graduate because of attendance. The other is a list of people who aren't going to graduate because of their grades. And I was on both those lists. And it wasn't looking good for the home team, but I ended up graduating. And when I graduated, like, I really thought, like, I'm going to wake up and I'm not going to want to do this anymore, right? Like, when am I going to wake up and go, this isn't what I want my life to be? I watched my girlfriends go off to college. I got into college. I didn't go to college because I had this boyfriend who was a whatever. So we looked cute though. We had, like, these matching, like, remember, like, track suits with matching Nikes? I mean, it was so retarded. Right? And he was a drug dealer. I mean, you know, I was, like, so cool. So I didn't end up going to college, and I got a job as a bartender. And, well, that was fun. So I would, like, you know, like this, you know, and then, because I'm 18 years old, you can't drink. And drinking, you know, and taking my boss's car to go buy drugs and stealing and all kinds of stuff. And so I ended up losing that job. And you know it's bad when you can't even bartend, you know. And so I ended up, I always get it confused if it was before or after, I don't know. Anyway, so I ended up getting a job managing this candy store. And so I would rob them because, like I said, that's what I do. And I had this boyfriend, I had his habit that I had to support, and my habit that I had to support, and whatever. So I'm robbing this place, and I end up getting arrested. My girlfriend had died. She got in a car accident, and she died, and so I had to go to her funeral. And so a friend of mine who I went to high school with was one of those security guards in the mall, and he was like, Daniel, look, they're coming. You got to get out of here. And I don't know why he did that for me, so I ended up, like, taking off and leaving. And so you get the warrant in the mail, and what is it? Throw it behind the bed. That's where everything went that I didn't want to deal with. I tossed it behind the bed. You know? Whatever. Who cares? You know, I was fine. I had my alcohol. Everything was good. My dad is like, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Because eventually the Lawrence Township police call, and they're like, we got a warrant out for your daughter. And my dad comes in, and he goes, did you get arrested? I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, and he goes, Dana, like, you can't do this, you know. And so I end up going to court, and they mandate me, and I end up in rehab. And so I go to rehab, and I meet this counselor, Gary, and he has this big book, you know, and he's flipping through the pages. I mean, if you're new, I'm just going to say this. If you're new and people are talking about pages in the big book and what and you don't know, good. You are not supposed to know. I didn't know what the hell was going on when I got here. Do you know what I mean? Like, we say these little things and you know, people, yeah, I had no clue what was going on. You know what I mean? You were all freaks as far as I was concerned. And this guy was like the biggest freak. And he's like flipping through this book. I'm thinking to myself, if I could take that book and shove it up your rear end, I would do it, you know? And something happened to me there, though. Really. I mean, he was a big guy, too, and drove a motorcycle, you know? And my perception of myself is so weird because I'm 5'1", and I weigh 120 pounds. But the way that I think in which I can interact and kind of work with people is so odd. You know, I would run my mouth and, like, pick these fights with these girls or these guys. I don't really care. And I couldn't back it up, you know? And thank God for my best friend who was 5'11 and like 140 pounds, and she was an athlete, so she always, you know, took care of it. But, you know, it's just my perception so off, so skewed. And so I ended up in this rehab, and, you know, Gary's quoting out of the big book, whatever. I learned about what alcoholism was there, and I learned about my disease, and I learned that, because I really thought heroin was my problem. Like, if I could just stop shooting dope, everything would be okay. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to smoke pot, and everything will be fine, you know? And what happened was I started to understand that this is a threefold illness, that it's body, mind, and spirit, you know, and that this affects all of me. And so I end up leaving there, and I go to this halfway house, end up, forget about it. This girl that I go out with, she has a stroke, and my mom comes. My parents come because they're going to give me a urine test. I'm going to fail that, so I got to get out of here, you know. My parents come. My mom's freaking out. She's got two different shoes on. It's like not a good scene, you know. And I go home, and I'm going to do this AA thing. I'm going to do this, you know. And so I go to AA. I go to like 10 meetings a week. I show up late, leave early. And I'm relapsing constantly, you know, constantly. I get this sponsor. I was doing both fellowships at the time, but really just mostly going to AA. But I get this sponsor, and I see her in a meeting. She goes, how come you haven't called me? I said, how come you haven't called me? I don't know. No, I don't know what the rules are, you know? And so I'm relapsing. I got to deal with this stupid judge because of this stupid charge that I have. And I'm just like, ugh, you know? And I'm relapsing. I can't stay sober. I'm drinking all the time. It's like a mess. And I don't know what to do. You know, I really, like, I'm trying, like, to get myself together. I can't get myself together, you know. And so I'm in this outpatient council, like, seeing this outpatient guy. And I don't know why I'm telling him the truth. Like, I'm telling him I can't stay sober. And you know, I keep drinking. I keep relapsing. I don't know what's the matter. You know, I'm going to meetings. And I have to say this. I'll be forever grateful for these women in these meetings. And what would happen was I would go to these meetings. I would go in the bathroom. I would do my thing. I would come out, and I would drool on the table. Face down, flat, drool. And these women never said to me, are you drunk? Are you high? What are you doing in there? You know, because if I would have thought that you didn't believe my lie, I never would have came back. But the only thing those women said to me was, Dane, this is where we're going to go tomorrow night. Are we going to see you there? I'll be so forever grateful for that, because we're not police. That drives me nuts. But really, we're not the AA police. I'm not the AA police. I want to be the AA police. I want to tell you how you're supposed to behave and how you're supposed to act. But really, I'm not, you know. And if it wasn't for those women, I don't think I would have came back. And so I end up, this judge is, like, really not happy with me. Because the rehab guy, the counselor guy, is telling the judge. I mean, like, and I looked at Jim, like, you're telling him? He's like, what do you mean I'm telling? Like, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to tell him. And I was like, yeah. So, I mean, but, right? I don't know, whatever. Again, perception, delusion, it's all in my head, and I'm nuts, you know? And so he's going to recommend me for long-term treatment. Well, I have heard about long-term treatment, so I give him a list of places, and I'm not going. He starts calling those places. I'm like this. I mean, I'm like a brat. I'm on my feet. I'm saying to my father, you better do something about this. I'm not going to one of those places, blah, 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 where they're going to make me mop the floor with a toothbrush. If you think that's, I'm going to leave, blah, blah, blah. I'm not doing it. So the hands up. My dad finds this place in Hunterdon County, and you need 14 days sober to go there, this halfway house. Yeah, okay. I mean, I went to rehab and was smoking toothpaste. Don't do this because it doesn't work, and the only thing that I did was throw up. But I'm smoking toothpaste in the bathroom to get high because I heard somewhere, again, if you're new, it doesn't work because I heard that it gets you high. I mean, I couldn't even stay sober in a lockdown facility. You know what I mean? I mean, I would have told you that I was 23 days sober coming out of there. But again, like delusional, you know? And so on August 16, 1998, I said my last foxhole prayer. I had gone to Philadelphia with a girlfriend of mine. We had a very odd conversation. Conversations like I have all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, but not the kind of conversations I had with the girlfriends that I was using with at all. Nothing deep, nothing intense, nothing. I don't want to know anything about you, and I'm certainly not going to tell you anything about me, and whatever I tell you about me is not going to be the truth. So we go, and I have a little bit left of what I got, and I was going to take it with me because I can fool you, you know, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, I dumped the rest of what I had down the toilet, and I said to God on August 16, 1998, if you get me a clean urine tomorrow, I promise I'll never pick up another drink or drug again. And he kept his end of the bargain, because since August 17, 1998, I have not found it necessary to take a drink or a drug. And I show up at this halfway house in Hunterdon County, New Jersey, and I'm going to tell you that if they took a head count of deer to people, the deer would have won. I mean, it was, like, weird. And I told you where I grew up, and this was, like, weird. You know what I mean? Like, maybe a little bit of deliverance. I didn't know. So, and I've been to the Southeast. So, and I was like, oh, dear. You know, and I go there with my mom, and you know, and she's like, okay. And I take this drug test, and I pass because I'm drinking natural flush and nuts. And I'm an 18-year-old spoiled little brat, you know. I want what I want when I want it. And they, you know, and so it's not like you guys have sober livings out here. It's not really like a sober living. It's like a halfway house, and there's definitely rules, and there's definitely structure, and you got to go out and get a job, and they make you get a sponsor. But I need to say that where I got sober, people just weren't working the steps out of the book. It just wasn't what was happening. But I went to this woman's meeting that the house took us to on Monday nights, and I met my first sponsor there, and her name was Jessica Kay. And she didn't go to that meeting normally, but, you know, she walked in, and like we do in good old New Jersey AA, we ask you to speak at the door. Why don't you speak, you know? So she told her story, and she was 21 years old at the time and 5 years sober. That was good enough for me. So after the meeting, I asked her to be my sponsor. Now, this is, I don't know why. I have no idea how this works or why God does what he does, but this is what happened to me. So Jessica had seven sponsors or six sponsors up until Joy, the current sponsor that she had when I asked her. None of those sponsors previous to Joy had taken Jessica through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Joy was taking Jessica through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what she did for me. And I need to tell you that my first sponsor and my current sponsor, I know there's a lot of, I see this a lot. I don't really understand it because it just isn't how I got sober. But you do what works for you. I'm not telling you it's right or wrong. I'm just telling you my experience because that's what I'm told to do. And so where I got sober, the type of women that I got sober with, my sponsor was not going to, like, I would call her for answers, right? La, 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 bitch, 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 moan, moan, moan. Tell me what to do. I don't know. Pray. You got to pray. Click. And what do I say? Help me is a good start for you. That's what she said to me. Help me. And that's all she did. Years later, I asked her, why didn't you ever tell me? She said, I didn't know. I didn't know what to tell you. And I'm so grateful. So really what I think was the biggest gift that she gave me, and the biggest gift I could give someone else is to just tell them, I don't know. That's the truth. I don't know. And all she did was open up the book with me, go through the 12 and 12 with me, and take me through the steps to the best of her ability. And what she forced me to do was have my own experience. Not her experience, my experience. She didn't tell me you know, make your bed in the morning. I don't understand that. Right foot, left shoe. I don't know. You got to go to these meetings. You have to dress this way. You have to act this way. You have to do. I don't understand any of that. She just told me to pray. Because she wasn't going to fix me. She knew I needed to develop a relationship with God of my understanding. And when I say the word God, I'm just going to say this, because for anybody who's sitting in the room tonight going, oh my God, I know, I get it, I totally understand it. I like that word, works for me. I'm not talking about Jesus, I'm not talking about the Buddha, I'm not talking about Allah, Judaism, any of it, but I'm talking about all of it. I find my home in that relationship, in so many different dogmas and so many different faiths and so many different experiences. I spent 3.5 hours today practicing yoga, something that I love to do, and chanting, and I read from a Muslim prayer book in the morning, and I practice a Catholic meditation, and I read from all different types of literature, and I do Hindu chanting in the morning. I mean, really, I just am so blessed. I love organized religion. Love it. I can't get enough of it. I love nuns. Like, I hang out with them. I think they're amazing. You know, I've been so blessed. And what happened to me was how I sort of got over the whole, like, and I had a weird, like, Jesus thing. And I don't even know why, because I didn't grow up going to church, you know. I had no reason to have a weird Jesus thing, you know. And so I had to make amends, and I was, a girlfriend of mine, she actually lives in San Diego, we worked together, we went to high school together, my girlfriend, Mary Ellen, and she was doing an independent study in high school, and she's the most amazing voice, I mean, absolutely gorgeous, and she's so talented, and just an amazing woman, and she had written this play, this one-woman sort of, like, play thing, and so that she was performing in, rather than show up for that, I went to Philadelphia. And she was just, like, so disgusted with me. And I couldn't understand why she was so disgusted with me. You know, that's how delusional I was. And I ended up, so years later, I write my, right, we do our steps. Do those steps, and I have my A-step list, and she's on my A-step list, and I make amends to her, and part of that amends, I'm a big fan of living amends, I think they're so much more important than anything I'm going to sit down and tell you. Part of that living amends was she was singing in this church, in this Presbyterian church in the town where we grew up for Christmas Eve, and so I told her I would be there, and then I showed up. Neat concept, huh? And I showed up, and I was so, like, I was sitting there, and I'm, like, a year sober, maybe a year and a half sober, and I'm angry, and I'm, like, all these people, and they're talking about Jesus. I didn't even know what that meant, and I'm just angry because they're talking about Jesus. And then I heard this voice, and I'm going to tell you that if you sit in quiet long enough, you're just going to, it's, God will just start to talk to you, and it's going to sound amazingly like your own voice, because see, this idea of God is not this idea of God that lives out here. It's this idea of God that it resides inside all of us, this light inside of us that we're just trying to let out. So I hear this voice, and it says, Dana, if these people, if this is how they love their God, why are they wrong? And I thought, you're absolutely right. Problem solved. And I sat through the rest of the mass, and the rest of this, I was like, oh, this is great, right? I mean, I love church. Like, I can't get enough of it. I'll go sit in any church, you know? And a girlfriend of mine, she was really into, like, Tibetan Buddhism. So we went to this in Washington, New Jersey. The Dalai Lama actually stays there when he comes into town. And so we go to this place. And so I had been, like, doing a lot of chanting. And so I go with my girlfriend, Barb, and we get there. And so we're sitting, and it's great because you, like, do a lot of, like, chanting, but they chant, like, so fast, like, faster than I could even keep up with. And they're like, blah, 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 and I'm like, oh, my God, you know. And so I just, like, sit there and smile, and, you know, people are clapping. And then there's, like, 20 minutes. There's, like, lots of meditation, which I love. So there's, like, 2 20-minute meditations that you do. And so, and I remembered, like, so I'm sitting there in my quiet, you know, and they tell you, like, how you're supposed to sit and, like, you know, in their practice, you know. And I always just do my own thing because it's just what I do. And so I sit there and I'm doing it, and I have this, like, dialogue with God. I was like, wow, like, you're not just here. You're in my house, you're in my car, you're in my job, you're in this meeting. Like, you're always with me. Never leaves, you know? And that's the gift that I got from Jessica. It wasn't like, what are the right meetings to go to or how to dress when you go to an AA meeting. I mean, if you walked into any meeting in the East Side in New York, I mean, oh my God, you guys would be appalled. I mean, we just come to meetings, I don't know, whatever. Not really particular, you know? And so there's just no pomp and circumstance. We just don't have any of that there. And they're an hour, which I love. I love an hour AA meetings. I was saying that to the woman before. I love. We have a saying on the East Coast, nobody gets saved after the hour. Love it. I do. I can't help it. It's where I got sober. But I always say this, and Shane was reminding me of this before the meeting, that I hope that where I got sober in Ringo's, New Jersey, I think it is the best place in the world to get sober. I will always think it is the best place in the world to get sober. If you get sober, if you got sober in San Diego, California, I really hope that you think this is the best place in the world to get sober, and I hope that you think this is the best AA out there. And I hope that when you go to other places, you're going to think they're just doing it wrong. Because everywhere I go, I'm like, Jesus, God, they're doing it wrong. Anyway, so, and I go a lot of places, which is so weird. I want to tell you a little bit about what my life has been like in Alcoholics Anonymous and what happened to me when I stopped working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you about Jessica, and I'm meeting with Jessica, and we do 1 through 8, and make that list, do 4 amends, and, well, I just know better than you. So I sit in meetings and I tell you that I know better than you. And I judge you. And that really, people respond well to that. You know, they love that. It's like warm and you're so inviting and welcoming. You know, people love to be told they're wrong, you know. So I became sick in my soul. That's the best way to describe it. I became so sick. I love people with 2 years of sobriety because they just know everything, and I knew everything way more than you did. And I find now at 13 years I know nothing. That thrills me. But I became very sick in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happens was, see, there is this gaping hole inside of my soul. And I used drugs and alcohol to fill it for so long. And then what happened was that ran out, right? And what we give you here is we give you these tools. And hopefully that's going to fill you up, right? Well, you have to do them all. That's the first piece. You have to continue to do them. That's the second piece. And then you have to go and you have to help other people do them. That's the third piece. So I didn't do that. I did them. And then what happened was I would come to AA meetings and I would judge you, and then, so, right, I'm not getting fulfilled. So I start sleeping really with anything that walks in front of me. I rack up $6,000 in credit card debt. I'm working like 12, 14 hours a day. I'm hanging out at strip clubs, like I'm going to bars, I'm sitting in, like going to my girlfriend's house, and we're like all sitting around smoking pot. I mean, those are the types of things that I'm doing to make myself feel better. Now, when you do those things and you're drinking, you have an excuse. When you do those things and you're sober, people look at you funny. But here's the kicker. You're going to love this. I'm sponsoring. Right? The gift that keeps on giving. I mean, and I didn't even know what the hell I was telling these girls. And I remember sitting at a diner when I was a sponsee, Lindsay, that I had, and she's like 16 years old, and I'm just like holding on to every word she has. I was nuts, you know? And I couldn't even, and I'm writing inventories. This is what I'm doing. I'm writing 4 steps because that's going to fix me. So in like a year, I wrote like 60 inventories, and I'm calling. I got a new sponsor at the time. Her name is Eileen, and we've been together now for 12 years. And so I'm writing these inventories, and I'm calling Eileen, and I'm like, you got to listen to this inventory. And so long story short, I end up trying to kill myself because that's what happens, to me at least. Because the only thing I'm doing is not drinking and going to meetings. And I was a mess. And I call my sponsor one last time, and I say to her, I got this inventory. She said, oh, my God, please, honey, do not. I can't listen to another one. Write your A-step list. Write your A-step list, come over, and we'll talk. I wrote that A-step list. And I take the 9th step very seriously. That's the step that we take out into the world with us, and therefore every amends that I make goes through my sponsor, even at 13 years sober, and every amends that my girls make goes through me. because I don't need to do any more damage to you than the damage that I've already caused you. And I've been one of those people that have loved to go out and make amends and cause harm, more harm than I already caused. And so what happened was I made that ASAP list and I started making amends. And gradually and slowly over time, I started to develop a different relationship with the God of my understanding. I started meditating and praying again on a daily basis. I do about a half an hour every morning. I go to meetings. I started going to meetings again, and I started sponsoring women how I was sponsored, by taking them through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the book. When I was 5 years sober, I got the opportunity to go to school in New York City. I was scared to death. You know, I really was. But I was ready to go. I was excited to have a new experience. And my whole world opens up. And I think I just celebrated 5 years or 6 years. I don't even remember. And I moved there. And, oh, my God, it was, like, awful. Like, and it was great because, like, we all come from other places. And we were all, like, be like, oh, my God, this is the worst AA in the world. But we, like, bonded over that, you know. And I found people were working the steps out of the book. And I'm just not one of those people that gives lip service to the book. And I don't quote pages out of the book. I don't have time to memorize the pages in the book. But if you do, that's wonderful. Do whatever works for you. I always say to people, I don't care if you know what's on page 63 in the book. I care what your experience was with page 63 in the book. And that's what I'm interested in. And so that's what I hope to share. And so I was going to meetings where people were talking a lot about what was on page 63 in the book. And I was like, okay, this isn't for me. You know, that kind of AA almost killed me. So, because I just like to compare myself to you. And so what happened was my girlfriend, Jenny, my best friend, she took me to this meeting in a Cabrini Medical Center on Saturday nights that friends of mine had started. And my friend Alex, who lives in LA now, I was just with him last weekend. He was 2 years old at the time and just a doll. He was 21 years old and he was going to NYU, and bless you. And he was talking about God, and he was talking about God the way that I knew God. He was talking about having an experience with God and building a relationship with God as a result of these steps. And he was talking about his experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after the meeting, I went up to him and I was like, I need to know you, you know. And he said, I go to this meeting on Tuesday nights called Young People's Step. I really didn't do too many young people's meetings, but he said, you need to go there and you need to meet my friend John. And I showed up there. I wasn't going to go. I showed up there on Tuesday night. I was waitressing in Murray Hill and in Manhattan. And I showed up at this meeting, and I showed up late, a little bit late, and John was there and he was speaking on the 12 step, and I thought, and afterwards they invited me over for a big book study that he has at his house. He had gotten sober in Minnesota when he was 15 years old. He was, I don't know, 18 years sober at the time. Now he's got 23 years. I thought he was the most arrogant son of a bitch that I'd ever met. Like, he sat on his book and it was like binded and like rulered and he had these notes. And I was like, who is this guy? He like cut hair for a living, and like I didn't even know what the hell was going on, you know. And my girlfriend Jenny was there, and like I said, if you meditate and you spend enough time in quiet, what happens is God starts to talk to you. And God was talking to me every morning, and he would say, you need to ask John to take you through the steps. And I said, no. Again, I'd sit down in the morning and I'd meditate, and he'd say, you need to ask John to take you through the steps. Not going to happen. Thanks for asking, though. I appreciate it. So what happens, though, is like God is very persistent, so, and he always gets his way. I mean, that's just reality. So after a week of that, fine, I'll do it. Whatever. Just leave me alone. And so I asked John, and I said, you take women through the steps? And he said, who? I said, me. He goes, yeah. And changed my life. Really, it did. And I wrote an inventory that was the longest inventory that I had written. It took me 18 months to write it and about 2 months on Maui. I came back to New York with this fifth step, this fourth step, and sat in his room and read that inventory. And my whole idea and my whole concept of God shifted in that time. And he told me about the word humility. He taught me about the definition of humility, which is hidden so lovely in the 12 and 12 in step 5. And all it is a clear understanding of who and what I am, followed by a sincere attempt to be what I can become. I get that clear understanding when I write that inventory. And I attempt to be what I can become when I go out and write my wrongs to you. and change my behavior. And we talked a lot about change in perception and change in behavior. And he left his room and I was sobbing. And I said to God, because God had was gone at that moment. I said to God, if you're here, I need to see you. Because I don't see you right now. And John was living with one of my sponsees. Her name's Alexis at the time. And I tell this story often because it's, to me, one of the most powerful experiences. And this is how God works. I'd gotten Alexis when she was 2 years sober. And you ever get one of those girls who you don't want to sponsor? And you're going, please don't ask me. Please don't. And you're like, this. You do one of those. Yeah, hi, good to see you, you know. And she walks up to me. She's like, John told me I have to ask you to be my sponsor. And I was like, kill John later. Yeah, sure, right? Because I don't say no because you taught me not to say no. Okay. And I don't make my girls call me every day. I don't have that kind of time. And so, but if they want to call me every day, they can. It's up to them. Whatever they want to do. Like I said, I don't tell anybody what to do. Just pray and work the steps. It's very easy, you know. And then what happens is they can't blame you if stuff doesn't go their way. They can't say, you told me. No, I didn't. I told you to pray. Right? Simple. So, Alexis didn't call me Alexis didn't call me every day. She called me every 10 minutes, you know? What are you doing, Dan? And what she did was she forced me to be a better sponsor. She forced me to be her friend. She forced me to let her into my life because she wasn't going to tell me anything if I didn't let her in. And I'm so grateful for that. And so what happened was I do with Alexis what I do with all my girls. I take them through steps. We get to her A-step list, and she has all these stores that she's got to make amends to. Nordstrom's has enough money. They certainly don't need hers. That's what she told me. Fine. I don't argue with newcomers or with sponsees. I mean, if you do, good for you. I don't have that kind of time. What I say is pray about it. I don't know. Just pray. And so fast forward now, 6-9 months later, to me reading this inventory to John, and so he leaves, and I walk downstairs after making this plea to God, and Alexis walks in the door. I mean, she's gorgeous. If you know her, she's gorgeous, and she's lit up, smiling. What are you so happy about, right? Come on. So she says to me, I went to Nordstrom's, and I went to Macy's. And I went to all these places and I made my amends. That's what I said. And I just said, thank you, God. Because I knew it wasn't me. And so that's how God works. What happens is when I create the space, like my sponsor gave me, just the space to grow, just the space to develop that relationship, I get to have a better life today. I need to talk to you for the next 1 minute about two people that I can't believe I haven't mentioned yet. My grand sponsor, Patty, and her husband, Bob. And Bob was 65 years old when I met him, and I was 19, and he was my best friend in the whole world. And Bob got sober in L.A., so he always told me how we did not do it right. He was long, very long sober. He's been sober now 37 years, and we're still like this. But they were the ones that taught me about God, and they taught me about prayer, and they taught me about meditation. And they never told me what to do or how to act or what to say. They just told me to pray. And they told me to work the steps to the best of my ability. And they gave me room to make mistakes. And they encouraged it. And when I met John, he would root me on. You know what I mean? Good, fall on your ass, you know? Because I was so afraid to fall on my ass, you know? And what happened was, is when I started to do that, when I started to hit my head, I got to know God just a little bit better, and I got to know you just a little bit better, because what I found is it's in those experiences, those places of pain and discomfort and embarrassment, that's how we come together, right? I stand up here and tell you how wonderful my life is and how everything is good's going, and you're in the back going, well, that's not my experience, you know? It somehow creates a space between you and me, and I'm not trying to create any spaces today. I'm big, hug into the middle. Right? Hug into the middle. Let's get to know each other. Let's share those places of our lives that we don't want to talk about. Right? And so today I can do that. My four steps have been lost all over this country. God only knows. Really, one fell behind a diner. Who knows? You know, and I have no secrets today. And that's the gift, because no matter what I told you, you never told me to go away. No matter what I did, God never left me. And I am so grateful for that. So I'm going to end with this prayer. It's my favorite prayer. It's what I say when I end my prayer meditation in the morning. Bob shared this with me when I was 9 months sober. I thank God for the day that he has planned for me, and I thank God for all the people that he has to put in my life that day. That way, no matter what happens, everything that happens is an answer to prayer. And thank you very much for letting me share.